Hi, welcome to the show. How about you guys introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Matt Hackett, one of the co-founders of Lost Decade Games.
I'm Jeff Blair. I'm the other co-founder of Lost Decade Games.
Okay. And what's your studio about?
We're a web-based HTML5 studio. We've been making games in the browser for about, I guess, 2.5 years now. And so we're really into JavaScript and the web and open technologies like that. And so since the browser has become viable for making games in the last couple of years, we've really been hitting that hard.
And okay, and what's the current game, or what games have you worked on before, and what's the current game you're working on now?
Our first game is called Onslaught Arena, and it was just this little game we put together as part of a contest, as part of Boing Boing, a really popular online blog. That game got a fair bit of attention because it was one of the very first HTML5 games out there, and it was this was like 2010. And then after that, we went independent in February of 2012, and then we started to launch some of our own games, like Lunch Bug is a little puzzle game for mobile primarily. And then earlier this year, we launched a strategic RPG called Lava Blade, which is available on the Humble Store, and that's mostly a desktop game, but we're probably going to bring that to mobile eventually. And then a couple months ago, we had a Kickstarter for our game Crypt Run, which was successfully funded. And that's what we're currently working on.
And what's the game about?
So Crypt Run is a it's an action RPG. It's one of our themes while building it has been that death is just the beginning. So like when players die, that's not the end of the game. Like the whole new world opens up at that point. It's got procedurally generated dungeons. It's like a twin stick shooter. So it's very inspired by games like Gauntlet, Smash TV. We've been really inspired by Zelda and Spelunky specifically. It's all about like skill-based challenges and coming into the game and always having a fresh experience with the procedural generation and all that.
And for the audience out there, is there a website right now that they can maybe bring up while they're listening to the interview, so they can check out the game or find out more about it?
Oh, sure. On cryptrun.com, there's the Humble Store widgets where you can purchase early alpha access. We're doing weekly builds to a couple hundred alpha backers. And then there's also a preview trailer you can watch. And then there's like screenshots. And there's a whole bunch of stuff up on our YouTube channel with regards to like development, time lapses, and that kind of stuff.
And how do you spell Crypt Run for the audience, Justin?
Sure. CryptRun.
Okay, dot com.
Yeah.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Definitely.
We have an international audience, so sometimes it's a little different. Okay, so that's cool that you did a Kickstarter. I mean, I guess, indies, Kickstarter, people have been talking about Kickstarter, and now I've seen more indies doing it. Why do you feel that your Kickstarter succeeded? Because I've been seeing a lot of indie Kickstarters that haven't necessarily had as much success.
We did a whole lot of research before we even considered doing a Kickstarter. Like, I had my ear to the ground for probably a year or two. Like, what people think of, like, the general mass audience is they either haven't heard of Kickstarter or they know about Double Fine, which is, like, one of those pretty rare, like, phenomenal successes. Like, not everyone's going to have that kind of success. What we heard is that, like, it really comes from your own network. Like Kickstarter itself as a discovery platform will bring a project a little bit of attention, but really your network is really where all your money's going to come from. And so we had spent 2 years podcasting and blogging and trying to get out and reach an audience as best we could. So we've got probably a couple hundred fans and followers who support us, and that's really where our success came from.
And that's kind of interesting because even getting in contact with you two was through, I think, a PR person, right?
We're working with Greg Love of Whippering.
And how has that been? Just because that's something like when I interview a lot of indie developers, they don't talk about that end, about actually getting a PR person or even doing some of this more aggressive type of marketing. You talk about having a YouTube channel and stuff like that. How important would you say that is for your game development and for your studio's success?
That's a really good question. With regards to like working with a PR firm and like business developers and all that, we're pretty new to it. We actually had the really good fortune of meeting Greg at Casual Connect a couple months ago. And we were part of, CryptRun actually was part of IndiePrize Showcase, which is this little friendly competition they have as part of Casual Connect. And so we met Greg there, and it kind of just like, you know, he lives in the Bay Area, and Jeff lives in the Bay Area, so it's like we're very like-minded people, and we're both at points like in our development and our careers where like it made a lot of sense to work together. And that's really what a lot of it has been, is just really just luck, like being prepared and being at the right place at the right time. Because if it wasn't for like getting invited to IndiePrize and meeting Greg, we wouldn't be working with a PR firm right now, and we would be, you know, farther behind.
Okay. It's really been it's been great because, I mean, as an indie developer, we often wear all the hats, you know, in terms of marketing, PR, development, everything, right? And so having someone else that can kind of own some of the various initiatives that we're trying to pursue as a company has been extremely helpful. And definitely, Greg's been awesome. He's been all over it. So,
yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, well, I was just going to say to the second part, you were talking about stuff like having a YouTube channel and a YouTube presence. And that stuff is all homegrown. It feels like something that's pretty mandatory if you're trying to like do the homegrown approach of like the guerrilla marketing stuff where you just kind of trying to find your own audience without putting a lot of money into it or without working with an external firm. And most of that's like the large majority of that stuff for us has been very homegrown. And like we just use iMovie. We just record with open source software and we just try to upload videos and just keep pumping content out there just to kind of find an audience and keep the audience alive.
I think it's really tough. I'm reminded of, I think it's a quote by Jerry Seinfeld, oddly enough, but he was saying that it's never been easier to be a comedian, but it's never been harder. And what he's talking about there is that it's so easy to just put your work out there on YouTube, on Twitter, all these various different channels. But because of that low barrier to entry, it's like really easy to get lost in the flood of content that's out there these days. And so, you know, as an independent creative person, whether it's games or music or comedy or whatever, you know, it's almost mandatory to have a channel like YouTube or Twitter or something. But it's not enough.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about offering alpha access for your game. Do you, like, how is that relationship between the alpha testers? I mean, do you know these people on a name-by-name basis or on a personal basis? I mean, what is the relationship between you and your fans?
Yeah.
It depends. You know, it kind of runs the gamut. There's some people that are extremely passionate. We connect them on many different social channels. They talk to us over email. They talk to us over Twitter. They post on our forums, and we're kind of on a first name basis with a very tight knit small group of these people that test our games, and they provide really excellent, in depth, thoughtful feedback, and it's been great. You know, and then we have other people where they're on the list and they get the games, but we don't hear anything from them. We don't know them personally. We've never really interacted with them on any kind of personal level. But I think that one of the things that's kind of helped us build really strong relationships with some of our fans is that we also run our own podcast called Lost Cast. And it's a weekly show that Matt and I do. And we talk about independent game development topics. We talk about HTML5. We talk a lot about CryptRun. But, you know, we have some really avid listeners to the podcast. And, you know, anytime anyone spends an hour plus a week listening to you talk, you know, they kind of get to know you on a more personal level. And oftentimes they'll reach out to us on our various channels like Twitter and the blog and forums and stuff. And so we've actually cultivated some pretty close relationships with some of our fans that way.
Do you have your fans call in and talk to you on the podcast by any chance? Or?
Not like as a call-in show, but we have had friends of ours and podcast listeners that were in the area on the show from time to time. It kind of depends on who the person is and if they're, you know, comfortable talking and they want to be on the show and talk about their own endeavors.
Would you say your podcast attracts more of your fan base or more of your peer base, like the indie developers?
You know, it's interesting because I would say that it acquires more of people who would like to start moving towards a direction where we are at? Because like what we've noticed is that most of our incoming audience tends to be web developers like we used to be, who are interested in games. And that's like exactly where we were, I don't know, like between 3 and 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And we just like, we took this giant leap of going independent and took that risk. And we've been working full time, like really, really hard on Lost Decade. And there's a lot of our fan base who are people who would really love to do the same thing, but it just hasn't like, that path hasn't been laid out for them yet. You know, yeah. Like they're either like planning to do it or they just really want to, but the time's not right. Okay. But yeah, it's been very interesting.
And, well, that's cool. I mean, what would you say is the most powerful channel, marketing channel you've had? I mean, has it been the YouTube videos or has it been the podcast or is
it's definitely the podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's not our ability, like, and throughout none of our channels are we able to yet capture a large audience. Like we're talking about very small numbers, like in the hundreds. But with the podcast, what we've seen is that for one, we find people who come from, like, they would otherwise have never heard of us. Like they're not necessarily gamers, or maybe they would never follow a blog, or like they don't even have a Twitter account or a Facebook account, but like they have a long commute and they really love podcasts. So that's how they find us, is through these channels they never normally would. And like Jeff was saying earlier, they start to establish a connection because they hear us talk a lot. You know, like we're talking pretty much at this rate, there's hundreds of hours of audio out there for us talking, and they start to get a connection with us. And we've seen firsthand that some of these fans get really connected and really involved, and that's super great.
And how do we for indie developers, how do you balance, you know, the benefits of connection versus gameplay? And what I mean is that there's a benefit from just actually establishing these marketing fronts where you're developing more of a relationship. It's more about relationship-based marketing. And then you see some of these other developers where it's just about they put something like Subway Surfers out, right? They do some marketing on the mobile platform, but they're not doing podcasts, they're not doing YouTube videos and whatever else like that. And they get 28 million daily active users. You know, because that's the question. It's like, what is the best approach? You know, because on one hand, establishing that relationship, you've got this core audience now that can promote your game. And then you see these other techniques where it's just crazy, you know?
I think it's tough because, I mean, it's like Minecraft in a lot of ways, right? Like,
yeah.
You have these indie games that are just complete runaway hits, and they kind of fly in the face of, you know, traditional game marketing because they have some hook or some gameplay aspect that is completely viral. It's especially interesting in a game like Minecraft because the viral channel for that game is basically YouTube, right?
But yeah, you know what? You bring up a really good point, because if you think about it, Minecraft kind of got big in that way because he had a blog, right? He had like he was constantly blogging. I don't know if he was putting up YouTube demos on YouTube, but a lot, because you know he was iterating. It wasn't like it just took off all of a sudden.
Yeah, he was putting up videos on YouTube. Like the very first time I ever heard about Minecraft, it was actually a post on Slashdot of all places, where there was this little game that PayPal had shut down.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's the first time I heard about it. Yeah, the second time I heard about it. Yeah, exactly. There was that viral video where he was just making a tutorial video about building a house, and he ended up burning it down in an accident. That was really funny. And so it was already telling these great stories, and I think that found footing because he was putting himself out there.
Okay.
It's interesting, though, because like I get to see the exact other side of this coin, because like my wife works at Disney, and so they have these games that have just mass appeal, and Disney has just a crazy big audience, and so they'll launch these games, you know, that they go out and like at day one they've got a million users, and that's like to them that's like par for the course, and then likewise they'll have games that have quote only, you know, I don't know, 400,000 users or something, and so they shut it down. And like those numbers to us, like 400,000 would be a crazy good hit for us. So it's like it's relative to indies and corporates, like very much to where you are in the industry, right?
Yeah, but I think a good approach is, like you were saying, is putting yourself out there. I mean, if you think about Minecraft, what's genius about it is that they don't do that marketing. I mean, maybe it's just natural now, but I just see, you know, what blows my mind is that you know, you mentioned mobile and releasing some apps on mobile, and maybe you read about mobile and it's like, okay, 99 cents, you know, you have to get that right price point and you have to use in-app purchases. And then you see Minecraft, it's consistently at the top and it's got the most ridiculous price ever, right? Like, and maybe that's the benefit of kind of putting yourself out there and establishing that unique channel where you get a lot of exposure.
Yeah. Right. And I think that putting yourself out there is like, it's a concrete thing that you can do that will have some results. I mean, it won't probably make your game a runaway success, but when you're talking about a game like Minecraft, I mean, it's difficult to come up with a game concept that will resonate that well with players.
Yeah.
And it's not complete luck. I mean, obviously, like, Notch is a great designer, and he hit upon, like, a really excellent game design. And, you know, everyone kind of strives for that. We strive for that. But in tandem with that, you know, it's certainly good to try to be building your audience through other channels as well.
Yeah. And, you know, along with is there anything else you want to add to the marketing front? Because then I'm going to move on to the HTML5 discussion.
Not really. We're learning as we go. And like we were talking about, like Greg from Whippering earlier, this is our first project, that we're working on together. So we hope to be learning at a really rapid pace. We certainly haven't found like any kind of a magic bullet, and we haven't really found any marketing success, outside of our successfully funded, Kickstarter campaign, but it's kind of an ongoing process, and it's like even marketers who are professional and been doing it for years and years and years, to them there's a little bit of magic to it. So like a lot of it is just being prepared, being in the right place at the right time, and like having a solid product.
I'd like to mention a couple more things actually. One is that it is nice working with someone like Greg because it's hard to make all these contacts on your own.
And for the audience out there, once again, Greg is the PR person that's helping you guys on the PR front, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
Yeah, and so it's nice to have someone that's kind of like on the front lines and doing the diligence to make contacts with all these people, because it's really hard to get noticed as an indie developer. I mean, a lot of these journalists are, you know, inundated with indie developers emailing them all the time with builds and links to their game and this, that, and the other thing. And so the power of already having connections cannot be overstated, I think. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that I think Kickstarter is actually a great kind of PR route for us, because while getting some funding for the game was really nice, I also think that having a Kickstarter campaign was one of the best PR moves for Krypton initially.
Okay.
Yeah. It feels like it kind of legitimizes a game, and it also is like a reason to be really noisy and newsworthy. Yeah, it's not just for the funding. It's also a great promotional tool. Yeah,
for the PR for sure.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, and that's something to keep in mind. I feel like developers, you know, indie developers have to find kind of a unique and novel path to PR. And part of that is finding these new platforms where you can get noticed. I know, you know, Kickstarter, part of the benefit is that basically, you know, you can say, okay, well, I was funded on Kickstarter. You know, or you've got this thing where it's like, okay, I'm successfully funded or whatever else. So, I don't know.
But it's a great talking point. And it, like Matt said, it gives you an excuse to be noisy about your game. I mean, there's only so many times you can say, hey, check out my game landing page. Check it out, check it out, check it out, you know. But if you're on Kickstarter, you can say like, oh, you know, we're this much funded and we've got this many days to go. And like, thanks for this, thanks for that. And here's some more goals. And there's a lot more just newsworthy stuff around that campaign.
So, in addition to that marketing front, you know, then you've got the technical front. You talked about using HTML5 for your games, and that's kind of a point of contention. You know, so, you know, I've seen this in conferences where people talk about, okay, you have to go native. You want to be as quick as you can on that platform versus HTML5, which makes it so that you can port it to a lot of platforms. What is your perspective on that? Why use HTML5? You know, we even think about Facebook, which was using HTML5 for mobile, and then they had to switch to native too. What have you found with HTML5 in terms of performance and the ability to communicate your gameplay vision?
You know, we talk a lot about our decision to use HTML5, and just as a company, Jeff and I are constantly auditing our choices, and that's one that comes up a lot because HTML5 comes with a whole slew of its own problems. You know, it's slow, it's very young, the tools are very immature and pretty bad. These days, we've been talking about this actually. Like, if we were just starting today, we would probably go with something like Unity that was tried and true and geared for indies, and we would just kind of dodge all these problems that come with HTML5. But we made the decision to work with it back in like 2010 because it was something we were very familiar with and very comfortable with because we had years and years of experience as web developers. But even to this day, it's still a sound business decision to use HTML5 because there's a lot of interest from local startups who have... Oh, got some audio problems here.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yeah, hello?
Hello?
Hang on one second.
No problem.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Great. Let me pick back up from... So HTML5 is still a really good business decision because there's lots of money in it. There's lots of startups and companies who, like, they want to give out contracts, they want to experiment, they want to dip their toes in the water and see what the climate is for this new technology, and that's really what's kept us afloat for the last couple of years.
Okay, I mean, for doing work for other people, I think that's fine, but when you talk about performance issues, and I mean, seriously, with some of the gameplay, and especially the games that you're talking about, I mean, isn't a little lag time make a huge difference?
You know, it definitely can. And with Canvas, we've seen that, like, the area in which we need to be good enough, there's a lot of leeway there, at least on desktop. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe on desktop it's fine, but what do you think about mobile? Because you see now, I mean, how important do you feel mobile is to your studio at this point? Is it still not that important? Is it more of like a side channel, or do you feel that a lot of your customers demand mobile now?
I think that for us, we've been trending more towards the desktop. It's a really interesting topic because when we started out, we were actually very much more focused on mobile because HTML5 was kind of like, you know, oh, it runs in the browser on mobile and it runs in the desktop browser and things like that. And so we were kind of trending that direction. But I think as an independent developer, the desktop is actually still a better place to be just because the mobile market has been flooded. I mean,
yeah.
Aside from the problems with HTML5 apps in general, which, you know, first of all, like, the discovery is terrible. You know, HTML5 apps don't show up in the App Store.
Yeah.
Once you've landed on an HTML5 game, you have no way of, like, really retaining that user unless they bookmark it to their home screen, which is not common.
Yeah.
Monetization is also a huge issue in the browser. And so for specifically HTML5 in the mobile web browser, it's not an important part of our direct-to-consumer strategy, but it's a very big part of our business-to-business strategy as a company. I think that in mobile in general, it's just, you know, wrapping your games for native is something that we do, and we do that on desktop as well. And so we've actually been trending more towards native experiences, but still using HTML5 as the underlying platform.
Okay, yeah. And when I said HTML5 on mobile, I really meant literally embedding an HTML5 web browser within a native app. So you would just
open up
a web view.
That's never going to feel great.
Yeah.
We use technologies like Cocoon.js to basically... it's kind of the same experience as wrapping it up in a web view, but what they do is they translate the Canvas draw calls into OpenGL, which is the fast rendering system on the phone.
And has that been pretty good in terms of performance then, or did you run into any issues?
It's pretty good on performance. I mean, it's not completely up to native in our experience, but for the kind of games we make, it's definitely more than enough.
Okay.
Something else to consider with regards to HTML5 is it's very fast for prototyping, and for us, it's like, that's really the same thing. Like, a prototype can be the same thing as something that we ship with, and, like, you can work objectively faster in a scripting language than having to, like, you know, deal with, like, low-level allocation and, like, having to compile every time you want to change something. Because for us, it's, like, as simple as tweaking some properties, refresh the page, and then, bam, we've got new content in the game, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, HTML5 is definitely good for prototyping and iterating. And then maybe when you've got the final game design down, or at least the core gameplay finalized, and you've mitigated the risk, you know, so people are responding to it. At least your most hardcore, dedicated fans, or you know, at least you've got a core audience that says, okay, I like this, and they're willing to put up with the delays. But I think then to expand to a broader audience, to really execute, you might need to then convert that HTML5 into something native, or something like Unity.
It's possible. I think that we've actually hit a nice area where we're able to deploy native feeling applications, at least across the desktop, very well. We use this program called Node WebKit, and essentially what it is, it's a wrapper for your HTML5 content based on the Chromium browser, which is what Google Chrome uses under the hood. And so the JavaScript VM is extremely fast, the rendering is extremely fast, and you get native feeling application. I mean, on Windows, it's an EXE. On Mac, it's a DMG that you or a .app that you install via DMG, and it feels just like a real application that you would download natively, and the performance is pretty good. And so I
see
think
what you're saying. Go ahead.
Oh yeah,
I was saying from that perspective, I think that I wouldn't. We already have the ability to distribute basically the exact same code base across web, across Windows, Mac, and Linux desktop.
Yeah.
So, like, I think that there's a lot of value in being able to pump out games pretty quickly. Like, I know if Jeff and I made the decision to go back and, like, rewrite the game in C or some other native language, we'd be moving a lot slower. And, like, yeah, with a young company like ours, we're not going to have a hit right away. We need to get a lot more experience and make a lot more games. And so we need to focus on quality a lot, but it's also important for us to focus on quantity. And say we do get lucky enough someday to have a game that's like a marginal hit. At that point, it might make a lot of sense for us to go back and rewrite it in a native language just to get better performance, or like just to target maybe like some specific hardware like Nintendo DS or something. Like, it might make a lot of sense down the road, but in the short term, it's great for us to be able to move really quickly with HTML5 because we can iterate and launch a lot of games.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think even I don't know if you've heard of Instagram, but one of the co-founders was talking about how initially they were in HTML5 too. It allowed them to iterate, but then when they wanted to execute, they went native. And, you know, that's the model that I look at now as something that's probably something to consider, because if you think about it, you have a lot of gameplay risk, right? When you're initially releasing something new, if there are a couple variations or even the theme or all this other stuff, you might have to iterate. If you're willing to, you know, to find the hit or find that sweet spot, you're going to have to change a lot potentially. And until you do, it's probably not the best idea to invest in native potentially.
Yeah. Certainly not as an independent developer.
But once
you know?
You finalize that, then like those little things like being able to, at least on mobile, you know, tap properly and get a response quickly, or you know, improving the response time by a factor of 2 or 3 or whatever else that can happen when you're developing native apps. That makes a huge difference, and that could be the reason why your app, you know, or your game becomes something like Instagram, or it becomes some kind of niche thing that's just a small audience. And so that's why I was wondering how you were able to balance that with HTML5, because I was actually watching a video. You mentioned Casual Connect. They put their videos on YouTube from the conference, and one of the videos was from this HTML5 developer where they used HTML5 to develop kind of like a mobile game. And I was testing it out and it seemed all right, but I don't know if it was as snappy or as fine polished as some of the other very powerful, popular isometric games that I see on the App Store that they were kind of competing against. Not really competing against, but they were mimicking to an extent.
Yeah, we've seen some of our other, some of the indies that we really like. For example, Derek Yu of Mossmouth, he originally made Spelunky for PC using GameMaker. And me, it's a brilliantly designed game, but how the implementation ends up playing in GameMaker is pretty terrible. It's not a game that I would ever spend considerable time on. But then they went, you know, he worked with Andy Hull and they released it on Xbox. And that then it's like written from scratch in a native language, but it adhered pretty strictly to the prior game design that was perfected using GameMaker. And then that final experience, like Spelunky on 360, to me is just pristine. It's just almost perfect, you know. Yeah. So it's like that's an example of someone using kind of tools that maybe aren't what you'd actually like to launch with, but they enable you to move quickly.
Yeah. And I think developers need to actually consider that, you know what, it's not enough to know one language. I mean, seriously, I mean, you mentioned coming up from web development. And I think in the web designs or web development space, you needed to know multiple languages, whether it's the front end, HTML or JavaScript, and potentially the back end, which is PHP, MySQL, or some server-side scripting. And maybe for game developers, the analog is that, look, you need to have your prototype language, which is potentially Corona or HTML5 or some other tool like GameMaker. But then you need to actually have your native language, your execution language. So you've got your prototype language, and Unity seems to actually bridge both gaps in certain cases. But I mean, it's something that I've realized recently too, is that if you really want a broad audience, you have to get everything else perfected. Like to really go mainstream, once you find that gameplay that has that potential, you have to really polish it. And sometimes the initial technologies that you use to do that don't scale to that next level.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that a lot of developers who work, say, at larger corporations like EA or Microsoft, those kind of places, they tend to have very specified skill sets. So like they might be, all I do is I'm a lighting rigger, so I just put up lights all day.
Yeah.
And I position them, and there's like, that's very technical, and it's a job that really is a full-time thing. And then likewise, you might have people who do nothing but put together prototypes, or like one engineer who spends their entire day doing nothing but programming the UI. And as a two-man, like a two-developer indie shop, we don't really have that luxury of spending nothing but time on, like, we're just gonna prototype the gameplay, and then we're gonna, like, you know, we can't live all day in prototyping.
No, that's true, but that's why I think there needs to be sustainable prototyping. Like, it sounds like you have a model where you're prototyping, but you're also deploying it to people to get feedback. And you've got an audience. You've got an audience, and they're going to stick with you. They're happy with the current experience, right? They're happy with the execution that you're providing. Now, to grow that experience, you've got your PR front, you've got your marketing front, but there's also that execution front, in my opinion. And I think part of that is just going to require, like you talked about, just having that awesome execution of, say, Spelunky on the 360. And maybe that's, I don't know how popular Spelunky was before 360 versus after 360, but that could have been the tipping point.
Honestly, it could be. if you think about it, though, like, there's certain games that, if you look at The Binding of Isaac, for example, I mean, that game was made in Flash 2, I think, ActionScript 2, and it was deployed as such, and it was a massive hit. And so sometimes, really, the technology that you use only has to be good enough if your game design is strong enough.
And
because that game is distributed on Steam, it's wrapped up as a native application via, I think, Air, and does extremely well.
Yeah, I think one thing to also keep in mind is that when that was deployed, maybe people were hungry for that kind of interactivity on the web when there wasn't that much of that out there.
Right.
And as things got flooded, and then Flash became more mature, and more people were doing games on it, and they saw the initial success, then it became harder to stand out. So I think there is definitely a part of being at the right place at the right time, or being at the new right place at the right time.
Sure.
That place tends to be an example, yeah.
I was just using it as an example of like a technology that was not native used to deploy a production game that was a pretty big hit.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because like the place that you need to be when it comes to getting lucky and being at the right place at the right time is, in our experience, it's always a moving target.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm just having these discussions because I'm trying to clarify a model that actually works best. And
sure.
And obviously that model has to be usually different than how other people have done it so far. Like you look at Minecraft and he did it in Java, when... When people are like, "Oh, you need to develop your game in Flash, and or whatever else," and it's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. But as you've worked on your studio, what would you say have been the most amazing, I guess, realizations or lessons that you've learned in terms of either game design or running a game studio or anything like that?
That is a pretty broad question. We've learned a whole lot. One of the bigger ones is that you need to keep in mind that, like, as you're working on any large project, be it a game or like a company, you know, things are going to change. It's more like you have the ability to steer your ship in certain directions, but like the waters might take you in other places. You know, like when we launched Lunchbug, that's not ever a game that we saw ourselves working on. But it was just like what the people that were in our network and the companies we were working with and partnering with, it's what they wanted and what they needed. And that became what our company needed. And, yeah, just like things change a lot, and like it's not always going to work out the way that you want.
Yeah.
Also, I think a big thing is scope. We've really gotten a lot better about understanding how long it takes to implement the games that you want to implement and what some of the features, what the ramifications those would have within the game design. You know, it's really easy when you're a novice game designer to just throw everything in there. You know, I want a game that's this, that, and the other thing. And really what you want to do is actually start with a very, very simple base. Like, the game does this, and it's very simple, and then you build and iterate from there. Because if you try to design everything ahead of time, you've almost assuredly overlooked weird interactions between all the different pieces that you've thought up.
I see a lot of people who are saying that, like, oh, I'm just starting to work on this game, and, like, I need to know what game engine to use. I need some advice, because they're, like, they're new hobbyist game developers. And, like, I've been there. I understand. But they'll say, like, their concept is, you know, Magic the Gathering meets Final Fantasy Tactics. And I'm like, whoa, calm down. Like, take about 100 steps back. You know, it should be more like there's a dude with a sword in a world, and that's it. Like, that's where you start from and, like, build up from there.
And where do you guys see game development and game design going?
You know, it's only getting more popular and easier. It's going to be really interesting because I think there's going to be a certain amount of game design kind of becoming, I mean, it's already very important, but even more important than development. You know, as tools and technologies get better, things like Unity and these really great IDEs and Game Maker and stuff like that. I mean, hopefully there will always be a place for people like us that really want to write code and enjoy getting into the nuts and bolts of game development. But it's really going to be interesting to see how the game industry kind of heats up competition-wise with all these great new tools and ability to deploy cross-platform.
I read recently that even UDK, which is like this, you know, giant AAA game kit, that game or that engine has the ability to make a game on par with something like Angry Birds using just your mouse, just dragging, you know, dragging behaviors around and just like attaching physics to things and attaching objects to things. And like when that's the case, the barrier to entry is very, very low. And there's already like GUIs out there like Game Maker where you don't, like, there is scripting involved if you want there to be. And sometimes it probably has to be, but it's like the barrier to entry keeps lowering and lowering. And when that happens, implementation is easier and easier. And that's what Jeff was saying, is like, at that point, it becomes more critical that the design is elegant and the design is unique.
And
I think it kind of ties into the discussion about like what game engine to use. And I think that a good piece of advice would be it doesn't matter. Because as we were talking about before, like, what you really want to do is you want to prototype something and you want to get feedback and you want to figure out if what you've designed is attractive to players. And if it is, then you can spend the time to bring it to native experiences.
Yeah.
But when you're just creating games from scratch and you have no experience, you're going to create bad games. And so the best thing you can do is just pick something you're familiar with and just, you know, iterate.
Yeah. And to be fair, as games kind of emerge, you know, different new game genres emerge, there's definitely going to be a place for someone who understands the mix of different technologies or being able to combine stuff. Because if you think about MMOs, you know, there's a mix of that traditional gameplay, but there's also understanding the back end, you know, in terms of the technology and stuff like that. And those weren't necessarily possible with one single tool. at that time. And so there's probably going to be games right now or games coming up soon that for someone who's mastered multiple areas of technology, whether it's the back end and the front end, whether it's data or some other new type of emerging content system, those people might have more of a chance to create interesting or new and innovative games. That may or may not work out.
No, I think that's a really good point because if you do look at it, like MMOs, I mean, they take they're not the kind of games you could create in Game Maker, you know.
Yeah.
I think when we're talking about prototypes like Game Maker, we're probably referring to like either small desktop games or casual focused mobile games. When you're talking about like AAA studio games and even more complex MMORPGs, they certainly do require lots and lots of infrastructure that's extremely hard to put together. But I do think that as these things get easier, you're actually going to see more games incorporate that kind of back end more easily.
Yeah.
Things like AWS and Heroku and you know, the web is a great back end, essentially. And you're seeing services like Parse and all these other things that are going to make building a scalable back end to your game experience much easier.
It's going to be a really obvious thing for us to like move forward and have stuff like Twitter authentication and like online leaderboards for our games. Jeff recently just took an evening on a weekend and he got Twitter authentication working inside of CryptRun. And we haven't actually done anything with that yet, but that's pretty powerful because it's just become something like native to the experience.
And that's what I'm talking about. It's being able to use maybe some of these new technologies, like even the Facebook API or Twitter authentication or some of these other technologies to maybe add or enhance the core experience of the game or even redefine or design new types of games that revolve around that core experience. Because you talk absolutely. About leaderboards. Leaderboards may make the game more fun for a lot more people. The same gameplay, just adding leaderboards makes a huge difference.
That's actually one of the things we're kind of pushing hard on getting into CryptRun at some point. I've actually prototyped leaderboards for CryptRun using Twitter authentication, and it's all using Node.js and Redis on the back end, and then just the Twitter API. And that's one of the things that actually was really easy for us to do because of our web-based stack.
Okay.
And also, coming from the decade, or we each have about a decade of web experience, like we mentioned earlier, like when Jeff was at Yahoo Games, in his mix was like Java on the back end, PHP with what he worked on every day, but the PHP was outputting HTML, CSS, JavaScript, XML. There's so many technologies in the stack, and that was something we did for a long, long time. So that's kind of second nature to us, just to work with all these different technologies, and that should be advantageous for our game someday when we can like juggle multiple balls and like start to get more tech into the games and have them, you know, connect with social sites and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about, you know, prototyping ideas and stuff. Can you talk about how you were prototyping game mechanics in your latest game?
Sure. So one of the things we did when we started this game was we just kind of, we knew what the core mechanic, what we wanted for the core mechanic to be, which was, we very much wanted to revisit the same mechanic as Onslaught Arena had, which was you're in this room and you are fighting off just hordes of enemies, and it's a twin stick experience where you move and you shoot. And that was kind of like just the core basis for the game. And so we started with that. And we, from the very beginning, wanted it to be a gamepad driven experience because that's one of the places where Matt and I like to play games the most. And from then we iterated on that design, you know. So the first thing we did is we added a character that you can move around and you could walk around a room. And then the very next thing we added was something that hurt you. And so then we kind of iterated on that and trying to find, you know, just the right balance between, you know, adding too much to the game and not having enough. You know, it's this constant line between trying to have all the pieces of the gameplay fit together in a nice cohesive way. But, you know, once you kind of get those base behaviors in place, you know, then we started iterating on different kinds of monsters, right? So it's like first there's like spikes, and the spikes just hurt you. And so that's a feature we added to the game initially, was that you can take damage from things. And then, you know, we kind of try to take that feature and we scale it across the board, right? So you've got one thing that hurts you but doesn't move. and then we added a thing that hurts you but moves around. You know, and then you can play with the amount of damage that things do. And so you try to like scale this one feature that you added to your game world on as many ways as possible. And so we try to keep the actual feature set of the game pretty simple, you know. You can move, you can shoot, you can take damage. And then we kind of iterate on the, all those axes as much as possible.
And have you been, have there been any, I guess, new techniques that you've applied to this game versus previous games?
In terms of design or implementation? Sure.
In terms of design or maybe even development process or anything else.
I would say the biggest thing in terms of design is that we wanted to make sure not to take the controls away from the player. And so we're not going to have any kind of like in-game cutscenes. And that translates to, it's like anything that we can, we want to do diegetic, like in the game. So like rather than having a list of say like, you know, here's the five achievements that you've unlocked, just like displayed in the, just like you'd see on the webpage, just a list of text, we want to instead put that in the game. And so like in Crypt Run, as you collect items and as you like find rare like rare swords and rare armor and all that stuff, those items appear in the museum. And so you can just walk around the museum to see how you're progressing through the game. And that's something that is unique to us as designers for this game, and something that we like a lot and will probably continue to do in our future games as well.
Okay. And, you know, are there any techniques that you do to keep up on your craft of game design, game development? You know, coming from a web background, I think the technologies in web change quickly, or there's new technologies coming up all the time. Is there any kind of equivalent technique that you use in game design or game development to make sure that you're up on the latest and greatest?
I think it just comes down to, you know, to being involved in the community. I mean, there's a very big scene around game dev and game design and web-based game dev. And so we try to keep our ears to the ground as much as possible. And I think actually just recently we went through and we evaluated a bunch of different HTML5 game engines just to kind of see what was out there, what our engine might have been lacking versus some other engines. And so we kind of try to pop our heads up every once in a while and look around and make sure that, you know, there's nothing new on the horizon that we're missing out on.
Yeah, I think that's an... Go ahead, go ahead.
With regards to design, I think it's definitely harder just to kind of keep your ear to the ground in general. With regards to, like, tech and keeping up with your tools and stuff, it tends to be a little easier because there's a lot of blogs and news sites that you can subscribe to that want to make sure that you have, you know, the latest and greatest. It, like, tells you, like for us, it's like, Chrome is our development environment, and so sure. We follow like Chromium blogs that tells us what the new features are, what we can expect in different versions and all that. But with game design, it's like, it's less of like, here's a new update, here's like a new tactic you should use or something. It's like the design tactics that were tried and true like 100 years ago when people were playing chess, like those are still valid and still useful today. And it's more like what people are learning about how the design can interact and exist with the technology that's coming up. With regards to just pure game design, though, I would suggest Jesse Schell's book, The Art of Game Design, A Book of Lenses. As I read that cover to cover twice, and that's just a fantastic read.
What about conferences? How important are conferences, or have conferences been, I guess, for your game design, game development studio?
I was going to say, I think that conferences from a attendee perspective have relatively little value to us. I generally feel like most conferences, they kind of target the middle of the road when it comes to their talks and stuff like that. And so maybe from a game design perspective, I would get more out of it. But it's rare that I've been to a development-focused conference that I didn't kind of feel underwhelmed by what they were talking about. I think, though, conferences have been great for us recently as an exhibitor.
Yeah,
we went to Casual Connect, and it was a great networking effect for us. We met a lot of people from various companies that we made some great contacts with. And we also recently went to California Extreme in San Jose and demoed our game there, which was a different but also very rewarding experience because California Extreme is more focused on game players, and so we got to see a lot of people playing our game and getting feedback in real time, which was extremely invaluable.
And
conferences.
Go ahead.
Conferences as attendees, if you're talking about stuff like GDC, those are pretty interesting because they are very much geared towards the middle. Like they are mandatory. I think if you're just getting your feet wet in the industry, you need to go. You need to talk to everybody you can. You need to go to all the talks you can and learn and absorb all that you can. And if you're in the middle ground, which I kind of feel like we're somewhere around there, you're kind of in this place where you want to just keep your head down and just work and just produce. And then there's also people who like are at the conferences who are, you know, way above us, and they maybe are at a point where they don't have to work anymore, and so they just want to teach. And so you've kind of got these, like, it's like the conferences are really critical for people who are just starting, and then also for like the people who are, you know, very far along their careers. But I think there's probably a lot of companies like us who are really just like, we kind of poke our heads up out of the development hole once in a while and like, oh, is a conference coming? Like, I need to get this done. And so we just kind of get back to it.
Yeah. And you mentioned California Extreme. How was that? Just seeing other people play in person. Was that a very powerful experience? Did it help, I guess, in terms of even getting exposure?
Oh, that was crazy good. That was hands down one of the most impactful, beneficial, just like positive reinforcement type situations. It was the biggest takeaway. I think that the worst thing that we did is on Saturday we both just did double shifts, and I think if we could go back we would have split that up because it was like the conference started at like 10 and it went till 2 or 3 a.m. and so by the end of the day Jeff and I were both just like zombies. But man, seeing just hundreds of people come and go and sit down and play for a bit, and like some of them wanted to talk to us and some of them were really excited about it. This one kid, probably about 10 years old, he played for 4 hours straight. And like his dad kept coming and going and was just chatting with us. And he's like, he's still here. And he'd like try to drag him away. And the kid just was relentless. He loved it. And that was really motivating to us, you know?
Okay. And then have you thought about going to, I think it's like PAX East or PAX West or something like that?
Oh, we would love to go to PAX. Okay. They have a very short list, and like you have to have a pretty high quality product and to get let in. And additionally, you have to like a lot of great games don't get let in just because there's very limited space. So that's one of those luck situations where you need to have a great product and then also be in the right place at the right time to get in.
And so for the audience out there, what's coming up next for your studio? Where do you see yourself maybe in the next year? And what new things are you going to try to?
So we're definitely going to continue to focus on core experiences. For a while there, within our earlier career for last decade, we'd experimented with casual a little bit and social and that kind of stuff. It's really not something that interests us. We want to focus on like people who care about skill, people who love retro games and like they want a lot of depth of content. We're going to continue to focus on desktop, but that's not to say that we won't also be releasing our games on mobile down the road.
I think that one of the things for us is also getting on consoles. Like I mentioned before, Matt and I are both big console gamers. We love to be sitting on the couch playing with a controller in our hand and playing very hardcore skill-based games. And so that's another area where we would love to move into in the future.
What about micro consoles? What are your thoughts on that?
Jeff actually has an Ouya.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I do have an Ouya. And I really like it, actually. I think that the thing holding the Ouya back, honestly, is just the performance. It's there's quite a number of pretty good games on Ouya, but it's not a direct competitor to Xbox in terms of the kind of games you can play on it. Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, it's much cheaper, and it kind of gives you the same experience. I feel like it's a little weird, though, because, you know, people's perception of it is different. You know, it's essentially an Android phone, and it's about as powerful as some of them. And people have a different expectation of sitting on the couch playing games with a controller in terms of, like, what kind of games they're playing and the performance of those games. I really like the idea of micro consoles in general because I think they're very indie friendly, which is nice. I mean, being able to distribute games like you can distribute mobile apps would be great for consoles, I think. And so I think that, you know, things are going to trend that direction anyway. You know, you're going to see, like, Xbox Live Arcade, I think, to me, is the preferred way to consume content on Xbox. And Ouya is like that out of the box, right? Like, it's just you go to the App Store and you download games and they download and then you play them. And I think that's the future of game distribution.
Okay. Cool. So any last words then for indie game developers out there?
I would say, yeah.
It's a really tough market, and it's only going to get tougher. So I think that the big takeaways for us recently have been, you know, like we kind of mentioned before, like, just do it and use technology that you're comfortable with, and don't worry so much about if you're using the best tech or if you're writing the cleanest code. Really, you just need to kind of get your ideas out there and see if they resonate with the audience. And then, you know, like we were talking about before, you can come back and make the execution better for various platforms.
I would say some of the very best skills for someone who wants to be an indie developer to have is, one, relentless optimism, and two, really thick skin. And if you have those, if you have those skills, or you are developing those skills, and you continue to just work for a long time, and you focus on improving, like, that's important too. You can't just be releasing the same stuff. You can't be as good as you were last year, because other people are going to leave you in their wake.
Yeah,
you've got to. Yeah, you cannot lose your optimism. You got to keep being positive and moving forward. You got to be okay with people telling you your stuff is crap and they hate it, and just move on and keep focusing on quality, and eventually, you know, you'll get there.
Great. And where can listeners find out more information about you know, your games, maybe your podcast show, and your YouTube videos?
If you go to our website, it's www.lostdecadegames.com.
Okay, can you spell that too?
Sure. It's LostDecadeGames.com.
Great. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, thank you.
Take care. Bye.